Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Sanofi, we had the pleasure of speaking with Carrie L. Kitko, MD, and Sagar S. Patel, MD, to contribute to the discussion around optimal disease management and research in graft versus host disease. Kitko is an associate professor of pediatrics, the medical director of the Pediatric Stem Cell Transplantation Program, and the Ingram Professor of Pediatric Oncology at Monroe Carroll Jr. Children's Hospital at Vanderbilt in Nashville, Tennessee. Patel is the Director of Communications and Media Relationships for the Division of Hematology at the University of Utah Huntsman Cancer Institute in Salt Lake City. On February 17, 2024, the GVHD Alliance held the second annual GVHD Day, flooding Twitter with the hashtag GVHD Day in recognition of all those who are affected by GVHD. In our exclusive interview, Kitko and Patel discussed the science of disease recognition, principles around treatment selection, and ongoing research with novel agents and biomarkers of response. What would you say are some of the current unmet needs in GVHD and why? Dr. Kitko, if you want to start us off, that'd be great.
I think we are very lucky right now. We have, over the last several years, been granted FDA approval for several medications, one for steroid refractory acute GVHD and three for steroid refractory chronic GVHD. And I think that's great news for our patients. The flip side of that is that not each of those medicines will work for every patient. We don't know as much in a clinical trial setting how to potentially improve outcomes by using combination therapy. And then what about trying to move some of those treatments up to earlier in the disease progress as well? So those are areas that hopefully we can see ourselves improving on our GVHD outcomes by utilizing the tools we already have, but figuring out how to improve upon those outcomes.
And Dr. Kitko, you know, I think the unmet needs in the GVHD space still include, you know, first-line therapies. You know, we're still using a lot of steroids, and ineffective as they may be, they come with a host of side effects that can make it very difficult for the patient. And so that's sort of one area that's been difficult to sort of move past, but there are certainly trials underway looking at new therapies or combination regimens that can help move the needle there. The other unmet need certainly has been our ability to find really great biomarkers. You know, there's been a lot of work that's been done in this space and still nothing that's quite yet ready for routine clinical practice. But that certainly would help both from a therapy development perspective and then also just from managing patients and having another tool to sort of help make diagnosis and then response to treatment.
I wanted to follow up based on what you just said about biomarkers. Not ready for prime time in the sense that results have been contradictory or just not robust enough.
What we're learning, you know, with GVHD is that certainly there are probably multiple pathways that are involved, and it doesn't fit into a neat singular sort of box that a single biomarker is probably going to be sensitive and specific enough to that disease process. And trying to separate the background noise of just having an allogeneic stem cell transplant is also difficult. And so there are going to be some intrinsic changes with just having a transplant that you have to separate out from this separate complication disease process. And so an ideal biomarker would be something that is reliable and sensitive and specific enough to GVHD.
Now, Dr. Kitko, you mentioned the several approvals that we've seen over the course of the past couple of years. Can you discuss kind of some of the data that supported those indications?
I think some of the best data that we have were from the series of REACH trials, which were specifically for ruxolitinib, a JAK1/2 inhibitor, in both the acute GVHD steroid refractory setting, as well as sort of after failure of 1 to 2 lines of therapy for chronic GVHD. They were both studied in a randomized way where patients either got the ruxolitinib or what was considered best available therapy, a list of about 7 to 8 different commonly used medications in both of those scenarios. So I think that's some of the best data that we have, where we really had a great comparison group, not a historic control, to say, you know, these patients really are having about twice the response rate compared to the current best available therapies to really support the use of ruxolitinib. That's not to say that things like ibrutinib and belumosudil in particular aren't also very important tools in our toolbox, but they didn't have that same sort of comparison. They were sometimes multiple arms using different doses. The overall response rates that were reported were significantly better than historic controls, but didn't necessarily have that contemporary control group to really say that the outcomes that look so good are as helpful as when you have a randomized controlled trial.
You know, some of these later trials that we saw, such as the AGAVE and ROCKSTAR studies, you did include at least patients that have been heavily pretreated and sort of, you know, helps reflect what happens in the real world, right? When we have chronic GVHD patients that have steroid refractory and into second, third, fourth lines of therapy and still have persistent or progressive disease. And it's always nice to see responses even in that population. And one would hope that that would translate into even better outcomes if that therapy was available in an earlier line.
What other research that has either been presented or maybe is ongoing still has really caught your attention and is worth kind of keeping an eye on as things move forward?
I think axatilimab is probably the drug that most of us are excited about. Again, what's been really great is the shift away from only thinking of GVHD as a T-cell mediated complication and recognizing that many arms of the immune system, particularly for chronic GVHD, are probably involved in that process. And so finding these new agents that target different parts of that potential pathophysiology have been really exciting, particularly the thought that axatilimab might actually have a signal to help against some of the most severe manifestations, the sort of fibrotic, sclerotic manifestations that are really challenging for our patients.
Even beyond kind of where we have our existing drug approvals, you know, there's work kind of across the spectrum. And I think in general, thinking of chronic GVHD is both sort of this inflammatory process, but then also this fibrosis element to it, which, you know, the fibrosis element is really what I think drives a lot of our anxiety in terms of, you know, how much of this is going to be reversible before it sort of cements in. And particularly when you have sclerotic skin features or changes in the lungs, you know, these are really, really hard to reverse. So some of these drugs that seem to have better activity in these settings, I think, is particularly promising. And that's probably where we're going to see some of the sort of newer therapies align, is really with having parallel options and sort of picking the agent that best matches the organs that are involved, because the GVHD is very heterogeneous from one patient to another. And so hoping to see that, you know, particularly for some of these more difficult to treat sites, that we have better activity.
Can you detail the process of disease recognition and diagnosis, especially given that heterogeneity that you mentioned?
I think there are very different stories for acute GVHD versus chronic GVHD. I think acute GVHD, again, focusing on that early post-transplant period, patients have bright red rashes, they have crampy belly pain, they have watery diarrhea. It's usually fairly obvious to both the clinician and the patient that something is going wrong here and easier to point a finger to. I think chronic GVHD is just a little bit more insidious in its development. So, you know, the patients might be doing well, and then you're tapering their immune suppression because they are doing well without any signs, and then they come in with skin itching or muscle cramping, but, you know, nothing distinguishing on exam to nail down the diagnosis. So you might be worried this patient might be developing chronic GVHD, but I don't have that diagnostic feature in front of me to change my management necessarily, because if I can get my patients off their immune suppression, there's downsides to being on that for too long as well. So it's this challenge that, you know, we have to describe to our patients. I don't have a blood test, right? Particularly for chronic GVHD, we're really behind in our biomarker understanding to be able to know. And so my best educated guess in a patient is they're looking well, their labs look okay, they're at the right point post-transplant, I'm going to try and taper their immune suppression, and I'll see them back in a month and I'll try it again. And then sometimes you taper and they call you back 2 weeks later. And even though they were having these vague symptoms, it takes a while until they can say, no, I do have this new rash, or my mouth is really sensitive, or my eyes are super dry. And that can be challenging for both the patient and the physician, I think.
You know, one of the other emerging trends that we're seeing is kind of the incidence of GVHD, acute and chronic, as it pertains to use of different prophylaxis regimens. So you know, one of the big advances sort of in our space is, yes, sort of from the treatment side, but then also just preventing GVHD to begin with. And particularly for many of our patients, we can now use post-transplant cyclophosphamide, which is very easy to do in a non-haploidentical donor setting. And that has really shown some significant improvements in GVHD prevention. Certainly, there's going to be a bit of a shift here as that has increased uptake amongst transplant centers.
Can you talk a little bit about the second annual GVHD Day and its importance to the field?
GVHD Day is a really amazing set of work that's been in motion for some time by the GVHD Alliance. And it helps sort of amplify, you know, really a relatively rare complication and rare disease, I guess, you know, compared to many things that one may see in the media. And it's particularly important for these patients because, as Dr. Kiko has mentioned, you know, it is very insidious. They can live a very long time with these symptoms that can be incredibly debilitating and have a significant impact on ability to return to school or to work and quality of life. And so being able to bring together, you know, caregivers, survivors, patients, you know, physicians, you know, the whole spectrum, multidisciplinary sort of focus to kind of be together on one platform, I think is really amazing. And so I think the GVHD Day helps and ties in really with as transplanters in a lot of our work that we do.
While this complication is rare, and certainly improvements in both our prevention strategies as well as some of our treatment means that patients are having better outcomes than in the past, we all have those patients that, for whatever reason that we don't understand today, haven't responded well to those treatments and are really impacted by the debilitating nature of chronic GVHD in particular. And so to be able to have the sort of forum where you can see other people that are going through the same thing or had a loved one that went through the same thing and then be connected to the transplant community that's working hard to make sure that we're not going to stop. We've made such good progress, but that doesn't mean we're going to stop. We're going to keep trying to find new pathways, new ways of using these agents to keep improving those outcomes.
Was there anything else that you would like to maybe amplify for our audience?
So there's the Mount Sinai Acute GVHD Consortium that has done a lot of work with biomarkers. And I will, you know, absolutely agree with what Dr. Patel said earlier in that for chronic GVHD in particular, the biomarkers are just not there yet in terms of, you know, helping do early diagnosis or even risk stratify. There has been work with several biomarkers, but with the MAGIC Consortium in particular, looking at a combination of two biomarkers and this sort of equation that helps risk stratify the patients. It's not ready for prime time at every center, but we certainly have been able to identify patients with high risk or low risk GVHD. And have run a few now clinical trials for the low-risk patients being able to avoid steroids, have decreased complications related to steroids, and now even maybe trying, we have a pediatric-specific study that if they're low-risk, maybe we can start on a lower dose of steroids and taper more quickly using the biomarkers to help guide us. So I think we're getting there. Again, not ready for every center, every patient, but I think we're closer for acute GVHD than for chronic.
And to sort of build on that, you know, I think some of the upcoming kind of studies that we'll be seeing sort of be, you know, evolutionary in the sense of using steroids plus some other new or existing GVHD treatment. And the goal there really is to see if we can use less steroids. And I think it's one of those interesting sort of dilemmas where I think the reason why steroids have been around for so long and so effective is quite simply they probably hit a lot of different targets. And sometimes the dirtier the drug, the better. And so it's a fine balance between something that is really targeted and focused against a very specific part of the pathway, but then also something that just hits a lot of different stuff. And unfortunately, whenever you hit a lot of different stuff, you also get a lot of side effects too and complications potentially. So that's always been sort of the push and pull. And so maybe some of these combination regimens and therapies, especially in our very frontline sort of settings, may still show that we need some steroids, but maybe not as much. And that could still be a positive gain for our patients.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by Sanofi. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.